So we'll discuss a little bit about nectar of instruction. Upadesha Amrita. This is a work by Srila Rupa Goswami. Small work, very small work. Rupa Goswami is called the Rasacharya. He's famous for explaining about rasa. And his famous works are the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and Ujjwala Nilamani. There's most famous works. And in these he explains about that bliss means a relationship with the Supreme Lord. And the form of Krishna establishes the sweetest relationship with the Lord. And so it's very, very much full of variegated bliss and sweetness. And he explains that different types of tastes of rasa and nectar devotion. And he goes into the details of the different personalities in Ujjwala Nilamani. So rasa is a very high topic. And Rupa Goswami also says near the beginning of the Nectar Devotion that you can understand bhakti and rasa not by intelligence and logic, but by taste. Taste will give you the understanding, not thinking too much about it. Nevertheless, he presents a logical analysis of rasa, what it is and how it operates and what its varieties are. He presents a very logical analysis of this in the Nectar of Devotion in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But we have to understand that we cannot understand everything with our intellect. We have to also have some sadhana and some faith and some taste also. So in that work, for us, generally we study the first part. There's four parts to the work. And generally we study the first part more than the other parts. The first part covers the general qualities of bhakti, sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti. And particularly for us, the sadhana bhakti is important and interesting. The other parts of the book are all about rasa. What is rasa? What are the components of rasa? What are the types of rasa? Primary and secondary. So it looks a little bit, because we don't have the taste, it's a little bit technical for us. So generally we study the first part, and particularly that part on sadhana bhakti. Nevertheless, it's important that we do have a definition of bhakti. Sometimes Prabhupada calls devotion a science. Just like we have material sciences, so bhakti is also something very precise. So when we have a science, we need exact definitions of everything. We cannot have sloppy definitions. We have to know what we're talking about and be very specific. So similarly for bhakti, if it's a science, it also has to be quite exact. So in the Nectar of Devotion, there Rupa Goswami gives exact definitions of everything. What is devotion? First definition. What is sadhana bhakti? Another definition. What is vaidhi bhakti? Definition. What is raganuga bhakti? Definition. What is bhava bhakti? Definition. What is prema bhakti? He defines everything very exactly so that nothing overlaps and everything fits together very nicely. So that logically we can know where we're going when we practice bhakti yoga. So he does present some sort of intelligent analysis for us to give us some direction in our devotion, even though, as he says, ultimately we can understand by taste, not by intelligence. Still, we can utilize our intelligence nicely in a very useful way to help our bhakti also. So this work, Nectar of Instruction, is very short compared to Nectar of Devotion, which has four big parts to it. It's an ocean with four parts. This is a very short work. It's only, the verse is only 13 verses, I think. 11 verses. 11 verses. So it's a very short work. There's 11 verses in the introduction of Nectar Devotion. This introductory verse is paying respects to different personalities, like his elder brother and Lord Chaitanya and things like that, and getting around to the definition. We almost cover 11 verses just there in the Nectar of Devotion. So here it's a very, we can say, concise work, a very short work. Not many commentaries are written on this. Nectar Devotion, many commentaries are there. Jiva Goswami has written, Vishnu Chakravarti has written, other acharyas have also written. On this one here, I think, as I recall, Bhaktisiddhanta has written some notes on it. Bhaktivinoda also has written a few notes on it. But someone like Vishwanath has not commented on it, nor has Jiva Goswami commented on it, even. Smaller work. Nevertheless, it's very interesting because it presents in a different way, in a little bit different angle. Not different, per se, but because it's so concise. It presents devotion also in a bit of a very summarized way. So on its own, probably, it's very difficult for us to understand it. If we didn't have Nectar of Devotion and we just had this work, it would be very difficult actually to appreciate it too much. Because it doesn't go into the details. It doesn't even tell you the difference between sadhana, bhava, and prema, or the difference between vaidhi and raganuga. It doesn't even go into those details. It just starts out with some instructions, and then it goes into sadhana, and then it goes gradually up into bhava and prema, one verse after the other. So unless we have some more understanding behind it, it may be a little difficult for us to penetrate. So this work actually should be studied in conjunction with the Nectar of Devotion. Then we'll get a more precise understanding of what Rupa Goswami is talking about. But anyway, this is like, it's a summary, so therefore it's called the Nectar of Instruction. Upadesha means instruction, so this is like the essence, we can say the essence of all instructions. And so if we take the Nectar of Devotion and we take the essence out of that, then we'll end up with 11 verses like this. His approach also is slightly different, we can say, if we examine the work. He brings up a few different points here, and at the same time he doesn't mention other things much in detail, which are stressed in the Nectar of Devotion. So it's interesting because he introduces a few elements here which are not there, particularly the first part, first few verses. So in that way it's interesting. So in Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami divides the bhakti into three parts, three things. Well, first of all, the definition is very important. What is bhakti? If we don't understand that, then other things don't make much sense, because we have to have a definition first. So that definition covers everything within the Nectar of Devotion. Everything falls within that definition. And that is that famous definition, Anyabhila Ashradashan Gyanakarma Naravritam Anukhina Krishna Nusilanam Bhaktir Uttama. This is the definition. So basically it means that activities or feelings directed towards the Supreme Lord with an intention of pleasing Him and no one else, that is bhakti. So it's a very simple definition, but it has a lot of implications in it, which are discussed in the commentaries of like Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath. They go into details, so the whole verse, all the each word they analyze and give us some understanding of it. But anyway, the essence is that activities or emotions directed towards the Supreme Lord with an intention of pleasing Him and only Him and no other intention. That is bhakti. So after he gives that definition, then he gives three types of bhakti. That is sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti. Three types. And then he goes into detail and discusses each one. And in sadhana bhakti, there are two types, vaidhi bhakti and raganuga bhakti. Two different types there. And in bhava bhakti, there's actually two types also that derive from Raghunuga Bhakti, and that derived from Avadhi Bhakti. And similarly, in Prema, you get two types. So in this way, he explains. So anyway, in the Sadhana Bhakti part, then he discusses the different angas. We can say they're activities, different things you should do in devotional service, engaging your senses, eyes, ears, nose, hands, feet, etc. How to engage your body and your senses in devotional service. There he gives 64 angas, or ways you can engage yourself, some of which are very obvious, like chanting by using the tongue, seeing the deity, or seeing the art with your eyes, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. These are obvious things. Engaging your whole body and doing parikramas or dandabats. Also anga devotion. So there's many angas like that. But before he does those, he discusses those, he has 20 preliminary angas, which are called the door to bhakti. 10 of which are positive and 10 of which are negative, what to do and what not to do. So they're called the door to bhakti because you have to enter the door before you get into bhakti. So in other words, these are preliminary activities that you must also do before your other angas or other activities of devotion become effective, even here in even though we say you just chant Hare Krishna, but actually there's 20 preliminary rules to follow which make it effective. So these are also angas, and they're the first 20 angas. The first 10 are what you do, and the second 10 are what you don't do. He doesn't go into so much detail. Rupa Goswami also doesn't. He just quotes a verse for each one. That's all from scripture to illustrate each one. He doesn't discuss them in detail at all. And then he goes over all the different angas like that, quoting a verse for each one. But he doesn't explain much at all. Anyway, it's surprising there, in relation to this, which we got here in the Nectar of Instruction, that he has the do's and then he has the don'ts. But actually, here in Nectar of Instruction, we get it looks like different things, because they're not mentioned in detail in the Nectar of Devotion. Some things, like the first three verses, for instance, the elements here do not look on the surface mentioned in there at all. So how can he write two different things? This is the essence of instruction. It's not even mentioned in Nectar of Devotion. It looks a little peculiar. However, we can see that they are more or less understood from certain of the first 20 angas of devotion. They're kind of included within that, not explicit. So that's why this is a little bit interesting, because he mentions some things which don't seem to be mentioned there, but they are, maybe indirectly. So, anyway, so we start out with whole precautionary measures, that is, we have the discussion of the vegas, or different urges of the body. That is the Vacha Vega, Manasa Vega, Krodha Vega, Jiva Vega, Udara Vega, Upasta Vega. So we've got six elements here. And these six elements appear in the next 1, 2, 3, 4 verses. We've got six unfavorable things, six favorable things, and six types of activities, sangha. So he continues this idea of 6, 6, 6, 6 in the next few verses also. Of course, it's not exhaustive. We can probably think of other vegas also. But more or less, they become included. We can always include them within these vegas, you know? The ones he's listed also are quite interesting, why he's chosen these. We could probably think of why put the stomach there at all. Could have put something else there. Or why put anger there, or whatever. Anyway, there's some interesting reasons behind all of this. So basically, he's got words, mind, and body covered. which covers all of our activities that we do. So the first one is Vacho Vega, that is words or talking, speaking. That's the first Vega, which can either act to our benefit or not to our benefit. And similarly with all of the other Vegas mentioned here. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says you have to control the senses, you have to control the mind. Otherwise, what is the question of any spiritual advancement? Why we have to control is because there is Vega, there is an urge of the different senses, and an urge of the words, urge of the mind. That urge is pushing, and if you don't control it, then it will go off and do so many things. So it's like wild horses, more or less. If you don't keep them under control, they'll run away and do whatever they want. So we have these different Vegas here. The first one is the Vacha Vega, or words, or speaking. So this is one type of problem that we have. Generally, we won't think about speaking so much. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna doesn't mention that so much. He mentions more of the mind. However, we do know that the process of kirtan is our main process. That is using the tongue also, positively. And it's a very powerful process for leading us into contact with Krishna. So if we don't engage the king, the tongue in kirtan, then, and we engage it in material things, then obviously we're not getting spiritual effects, we're getting material results. So just as powerfully the tongue can lead us into spiritual life, at the same time if we indulge in material talk, it can lead us into material world very, very strongly also. In other words, the influence of the tongue is very strong, one way or the other. It can elevate us spiritually, or it can pull us into the material world. That is a speaking, words. So it's a very interesting sense. It is not a knowledge gathering sense. It's called a working sense, a karmendriya, not a ganendriya. So it doesn't gather knowledge from the world. Rather, it seems to express knowledge. But if it expresses material knowledge, then it becomes a source of bondage for us. The mind and the words are quite intimately related together. And we have a mind which thinks all sorts of things. And then they form into thoughts, and thoughts turn into sentences, and the sentences turn into words, talking like this. So words can be an expression of the mind to reinforce the thinking of the mind. Whatever your material mind is thinking, then it comes out in words, and then it becomes stronger. So it's an expression of the mind, and it also then influences the mind back again, and makes the thought even stronger. So it's quite a strong influence. So this is one Vega that has to be controlled, the force of words. Then we have Manasa and Krodha Vega. But of course we'll say that the anger is in the mind, so why we have control the mind and then control the anger? So Bhaktivinoda has explained that actually the Manasa here will mean the mind filled with kama or desire, whereas the krodha is also in the mind, but that is filled with the opposite of desire, that is dislike. So we have like and dislike. These are the two tendencies of the mind, ichchadvesha. I want that, and then the other one is I don't want that. Take it away, I don't like that. I hate it. So we have these two tendencies in the mind, actually, both in the mind. One is desire, one is hatred. So that is expressed here. Manas is more or less the kama, and krodha is the negative one, the hate. So we have these two forces. They're both mental, of course. And these are the things that Krishna is urging us to control. He says, Icha Dvesha Sumutina Dandra Mohina Bharata. It is due to Icha and Dvesha. In this material world, this creates the dualities, this creates the illusion of the material world by which we go from body to body. And the desires, the Icha Dvesha, desire and hatred, are held in the mind. So one is the desire to get some enjoyment, and then to do that, then we use our senses, our action senses, and our knowledge gathering senses, and we do actions in the world to get our enjoyment, to get things and then to enjoy them. So the desire comes from the mind to do that, then we do the acts, which will be called sinful activities if they're not done under regulation. Then we get our enjoyment. Then the mind thinks about it again and says, I want more. We get an experience and then we get some more desire. All those are happening in the mind. So therefore, we say the mind is generating us into doing more and more activities in the material world and increases our desire for enjoyment. Then we get an obstruction to our enjoyment. Things which obstruct what we want to enjoy, that frustrate our enjoyment, we don't like those things. So these become the objects of dvesha or hatred. I don't like these things. They interrupt my happiness. They cause me pain. So there's only one influence, that is I want to enjoy, desire. But then when we get interrupted, then we get to develop the other one, hatred. But it stems from the desire, actually. If we have no desire, we have no hatred. So first comes the itcha, then comes the dvesha. But nevertheless, these two things are very, very strong in us. But it's all based on the desire to enjoy. So Krishna in Bhagavad Gita keeps saying you have to control the mind. If you don't control the mind, nothing's going to happen. So desires are there. And these desires are desires for my enjoyment. And in bhakti, the definition is that we should direct everything with an intention of pleasing Krishna, not ourself. So kama has to be absent. It's without any other desire. No abhilasha, no anya abhilasha, no other desire but then the desire to please Krishna. So the kama cannot be there. So if we indulge in these enjoyment activities for ourselves, then how is it possible to do bhakti? It's opposite. It's forbidden by the very definition of bhakti. Only for Krishna, only with the desire to please Krishna and nothing else. So they're going in opposite directions, basically. One is going this way, one is going that way. One is going to Krishna, one is going to the material world. So, therefore, if we engage the mind in all these desires, hatred, how we can advance the devotional service. So therefore, it is necessary to control the mind. However, Krishna is also very merciful, and he doesn't expect complete control immediately. And therefore we start with a little bit. And Krishna says, okay, that's good enough. So the first little bit is called faith. If we have a little faith, and then we attempt to do something for Krishna, Krishna says, okay, I accept it. Even though it's not perfect and it's not pure. It's 99% Maya still. But still Krishna says, okay, I accept it. Because he understands we're not going to surrender completely anyway in the beginning. We've got to start somewhere. So therefore, he introduces sadhana bhakti. It's not real bhakti, but he'll call it bhakti for us and accept it. And he'll give us mercy. So our mind is still desiring there. We still have icha dvesha. We haven't controlled it completely. We controlled it to one small speck, to the degree that we have faith and we do some devotional service based on that. Okay, we've controlled. But by and large, it's still there. Desires are still there. But through the process of practice of bhakti, then these things should decrease. That should be the effect of bhakti, that these things will gradually decrease. And we have anartana vritti taking place when we reach nishta, ruchya, sakti. That means surrender to Krishna increases, and these things will automatically decrease. Then we could say, why we have to control it all? Then we just do bhakti yoga. True. The process is that we're emphasizing the engagement in Krishna's service rather than control the mind, stop the mind. We're saying engage rather than control. So our process of control actually is, let us engage our senses for Krishna with an intention of pleasing Him. That's important. If we engage it while we're still thinking, I'm going to enjoy it, then it's not bhakti. So we always have to have that intention of doing it for Krishna, for His pleasure, not for myself or anybody else. Then it becomes effective to gradually get us out of this ichha dvesha, desire and hatred. We cannot deliberately indulge both ways. That is, okay, I'll do my devotional service, and then after I do my devotional service, then I'll go back and enjoy my senses. If we keep doing that, this is very detrimental for us. We have to keep trying to do it for Krishna and not go backwards, because otherwise you simply negate what we do. We're going one direction for Krishna, then we take two steps backwards this way. So that is why we have some four regulator principles, for instance. Don't do this, don't do that. That is a restriction. That's our minimum. Sense control. So we do have some sense control. In other words, the manasa krodha vega has got some limitation on it by these rules and regulations. But interestingly enough, we see in Nectar of Devotion, he doesn't really mention these things so much. We don't see the regulator principles mentioned anywhere there. As far as the angas of bhakti are concerned, he doesn't mention them. Not directly, anyway. However, if we look in the second 10 angas, there, one of the things is, don't be under the control of lamentation, etc. So we can say, kama, krodha, soka, all these different things. Don't come under the control of these different things, disturbances of the mind. And so he doesn't mention directly there, but he mentions that. Consequently, we have to control the senses, control the desires, refrain from certain activities which are sinful, etc. So here, with manasa krodha vega, we got desire and hatred. We have to control these two things which are in the mind. So these are the mental vegas, the sankalpa vikalpa in the mind, and we replace that with favorable service to Krishna. Then we got jiva vega, udara vega, upasta vega, three vegas representing the body. And there's the tongue, the belly, and the genital. So the in one sense, easy to understand, we have a tongue which, apart from speaking, it also eats, has a desire for taste. So we have a desire to enjoy taste, rasa, material rasa. And as we know from the prasad prayer, that the tongue is very difficult to control, and it leads us into the net of samsara in this material world. Simply by eating, we can end up in maya. So it's also a very strong vega, even though it looks insignificant, because what's wrong, eating is not a big deal, but it can lead you into the material world. Why? It's because eating, of course, involves the taste of things, and we like to eat things which taste nice, we think are nice. However, what tastes nice may not necessarily be beneficial for us spiritually. So we cannot always relate nice taste to good for us. It could be bad for us. Not even spiritually speaking, but even physically speaking, it can also be bad for you, even though it may taste good. Huh? So therefore, we have to have some discretion, just as even with anything we do, it may look nice or we may feel good, but not necessarily beneficial for us. It could be harmful for us. Anything like alcohol or cigarettes or anything. It may feel nice, but it's very detrimental for you. So we always have to look after the long-term benefit, not just see the short-term benefit. So all the senses, we can say, are represented here, not just three things, but we can actually say all the 10 senses we can have represented here with these by these three, which the jiva is quite strong. And it is quite significant because it is through this that we ingest food into our body. So we're actually taking material things in the body. With eyes, you don't do that. You know, you just kind of look at something and you get an impression here and whatever. But we're actually taking material in with our eating process. And the eating depends on the tasting. If we don't like it, we don't eat it. And so we take what we like and we eat it, and it goes into our body. So that material stuff goes into our body, and then it gets digested and it goes throughout your system. So your body is made up of all these things that you eat, which are made out of gunas also. They have certain qualities to them. And these qualities influence your body, and they also influence your mind. So in other words, you are what you eat mentally and physically. The food from the outside goes in, depending on your taste and your desire. It goes in and it influences you. So if you eat food in the mode of ignorance, then you become ignorant. And if you eat food in the mode of passion, you become passionate. You won't eat food in the mode of goodness, then you end up in the mode of goodness. So we cannot say that a person simply is born in the mode of ignorance and stays in the mode of ignorance. By changing his food, he can actually change his mind. But it takes intelligence. Someone in the mode of ignorance generally doesn't have enough intelligence to do anything. No motivation to change. So just stay in the mode of ignorance. He needs some good influence to push him to do something. Mm-hmm. One in the mode of goodness, of course, is he's got a little more intelligence already, so he's in a much better position. So anyway, we are affected by the things we eat, the modes of nature. And this will affect what we think and what we do. And of course, then we have prasadam, which is spiritual. Taking prasadam is one of the angas of bhakti. To take the food offered to the deity, this is an anga of bhakti. It is one of those things. It's directing your senses favorably towards the Supreme Lord with the desire to please him and nothing else. It's one of the angas. So we can control the jiva vega by this, by taking prasadam. If we want to taste, we taste prasadam, which is spiritual food. And this purifies us. It's an anga of bhakti, so it purifies us and further develops our attraction to Krishna and our distaste for material things. So that's how we can engage the tongue, jiva vega. So it can be used one way or the other. It can be used positively or negatively. It can lead us into the material world. It can also lead us out of the material world. Then we have the udara, or the belly. So the belly doesn't taste things, it just digests things, actually holds things. The enjoyment is by the tongue, in general, the taste. However, there is the urge to fill the belly. Just like when you're starving, you don't taste so much. You just want to fill up the belly and put something in there. So it's another urge. And in some people, it's a very strong urge. If they haven't had food all their life, generally they have this food complex. They got to keep their stomach full all the time. They keep eating and eating and eating and eating, keeping it full all the time. Otherwise, they feel insecure. their existence is threatened. They don't have any food. So they have to keep eating and filling their stomach. So there's another urge. And again, just like the tongue one, if we just keep stuffing our belly with food, it's also not good because all sorts of gunas are going in there, and this affects your mind again. So it's another unhealthy urge that you have to control. And then we have the upastavega, that is the sex urge, that is the urge for enjoyment using the genital. So this also is a very strong urge, which is there in all species and in the human being also. And in the human species, we have regulation of this through married life. There's rules and regulations for control, because it is a strong urge. And if we go beyond that, then we say the vega is out of control. If we go beyond the married life, then it is uncontrolled. So this is sometimes called the bondage, the real bondage of the material world. This leads to attachment, and then we get the whole family, house, children, relatives, properties, money, vehicles, whole list of things coming out of this, attachments, further attachments. So it leads to more and more attachment in the material world. Here we have a whole list of things. So for the bodily ones, actually we can also include other vegas. We have the eyes, we have the ears. These are also vegas, different senses. We can say they're understood here. He's given three, but we can also include the other ones also. All of which can lead us into trouble in the material world because we want to enjoy with the different senses. So anyway, we have the list here. Another way of looking at it, of course, is that this is not maybe recognized or whatever. Just another thing I thought of. In terms of chakras, anyway, the different chakras in the body. And so the chakras are related with different senses and also different emotions, actually, and also different stages of existence that we go through. So the Muladhara chakra, the first chakra, is your survival mode, basically. We have the what are called the different koshas also related to this. You know, the Annamaya kosha and the Pranamaya kosha and the Manamaya and the Ganamaya and the Ganamaya and Anandamaya koshas, which are, we can say, progressively more subtle levels of existence we go on in the material world. So that's also represented by the chakras. From the lowest chakra is very survival, like the Annamaya vision, and probably even the second chakra, the sex chakra. And then we get up into the belly region and the solar plexus region, and it starts getting into the mental sphere and the lower emotions. So this is where we get the udara and the upasta, the sex chakra, and then the belly chakra and solar plexus, this whole area here. Kama and krodha and all these things get stored in this area here, in the chakras. And then we get the heart chakra, and then we get here the voice chakra. And then we get up here, we get the mind, intellect, and buddhi chakra. And then we get the spiritual one on top. So what is interesting here is that, of course, in yoga, they try to purify the different chakras. And in this way, they can purify the life airs, etc. And they go from the lower to the higher, up like that, through mechanical means and breathing, etc. But there's an important bridge, progression here. Okay? And if we're not doing yoga and we're just in the material world, then we go from the bottom and up. Of course, as human beings, basically, we end up in the middle someplace, so with the maybe around the solar plexus region, we get that far. And we're somehow utilizing these lower chakras. And then in modern life, it's very peculiar because suddenly we jump up to the intellectual chakra and we start developing this one up here and with our thought processes a lot. And at the same time, we jump back down to here into the belly region for gross material enjoyment and all sorts of negative emotions. Huh? And we neglect the heart chakra completely. Huh? So we get a very unbalanced type of human being on the subtle level, huh? In terms of his subtle body and his chakras. We get a very, not a natural development there taking place. So, and as a result of that, everything gets disturbed. So naturally one should go from the bottom all the way up. So therefore from here we should go to here, get to the heart chakra, and then go upwards. But generally we skip that out. So that's basically the problem in the material world at the moment. We got a lot of intellect and a lot of hatred and a lot of lust. And no love. So that's the problem in the world. And we skipped out the middle chakra and just went up here and started thinking a lot. So it's interesting to know that this is some Karmi book, of course. But some person, he was talking about the chakras, and then he said that the yoga system actually, of course, is good, but it is dangerous. Because if you are not actually, prepared in terms of emotions and mental state and everything else, and artificially open the chakra, it's very dangerous. But he says, therefore, we have to prepare ourselves, and the best way to prepare yourself is by doing selfless service, and this will open the heart chakra. And when the heart chakra is open, then everything else naturally develops. So he says, therefore, you do selfless service. So we just take that a little further. We can say by devotional service, then naturally the heart chakra and all the other chakras should develop nicely so that, of course, it's mental. Let's say it's a material thing. But just like we have a physical body, the mental body also will naturally develop through the process of bhakti. So, and if the mental body develops naturally, then you can be peaceful. But if it's not developing naturally, you cannot be peaceful. And therefore you cannot think of Krishna even, because you have to use the mind to think of Krishna. So if you don't have any peace of mind, it's very difficult to do bhakti yoga. So bhakti itself concentrates on the heart chakra, in one sense, on one level. It's expressed through the heart. The definition of bhava is that the heart becomes softened. And the definition of prema is it becomes melted. The heart becomes melted. So it's always the heart. Of course, it's not the physical heart or the heart chakra. It's actually in the soul. But at the same time, it has a reflection in the subtle body also. So therefore, as Rupa Goswami said, you have to taste not through intellect. You're going to understand bhakti, and it's through the heart, not through the intelligence, that you understand. So anyway, the vagas are there, and they're also reflected in the we could say in the chakra system also, and they all have to be, let's say, balanced. Not out of control. You can say satisfied, but not irregularly or out of control. And gradually we have to, one after the other, bring them up to a peaceful level. So in doing so, we will control all the vagas also. The point is that through bhakti yoga, we can actually bring about this peacefulness of the subtle body and the physical body by practice of bhakti yoga. So anyway, here in this verse it is stated that these are the vegas, and that person, intelligent person, who is able to control these vegas, and then he can teach the whole world. He can rule the whole world or control the whole world, and he can teach the whole world by good example. So this in itself, of course, is not bhakti. If one can simply control the senses, that doesn't make you a devotee. You can say that mayavadis also control the senses, and so many people control the senses and regulate their activities. That in itself is not bhakti yoga. However, it is also essential that we do control, and it's essential we don't purposefully indulge in material pleasure of this world using these with the different vegas, because this will restrict our efforts to surrender to Krishna. That is, anukunya Krishna anusilanam, this doing acts of devotion with the intention of pleasing Krishna. This is negated when we start intentionally trying to use the vegas to enjoy in the material world. So in that sense, it's necessary that we do have some control. As well as performing bhakti yoga, we have to beware of doing the opposite. So these are the opposite things when we let the vegas go out of control. And if so, then we don't progress in devotional service. So, question?
Arjuna mentioned in the Gita asking Krishna, how is it that we're doing sinful activities of this as if by force? Krishna says it's lust. So,
Kama.
Is this urges we're hearing here, is this different aspects of that same lust?
Which are these urges here?
The urges,
Yeah.
Love, the connection with
motor passion. Rupa Goswami also analyzes suffering in the material world. The suffering is due to karma. Karma is due to activities. Activities are due to desire. Then we take a material body, say I'm in the material body, then we start enjoying, I have a desire to enjoy, then we get our senses and we start going out in the material world and trying to satisfy them in different. So, in other words, all these different vegas are ultimately related to the desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, which is the kama. And from that comes all the different senses with their vega and trying to get the enjoyment. Ultimately, kama goes back to kama, which is held in the mind, but actually it's deeper than that. It's going back to the soul. The soul makes a choice to be separate from God. I want my own type of enjoyment, not God's enjoyment. That's the soul's choice. Then we end up with all this.
That desire to enjoy, like we hear, pure love is comes in contact with motor passion, it's transformed into lust.
Yeah.
But the living into the inner spiritual world, he hasn't come in contact with the three modes.
No, he's got prema.
but it's just, I mean, you say misuse of independence.
Yeah.
But what would be the impetus to misuse that independence?
Of course, Bhaktivinoda gives an example, a controversial example for us, maybe. That is, the jiva's in the middle, like a fish in the water. And he goes either to one bank or the other. He's in the water, and then he can go to the right side or the left side. So the jiva can choose to serve God, or he can choose material energy. I think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says it is like the jiva is in neutral rasa, but that is unstable. It's not he wants to be active and do something, so therefore he goes one way or the other. Either serve Krishna or serve myself. One or the other. He makes that choice. But to say when? No, cannot say when. there's also limits. limits for us. In other words, if you could probably stuff your belly with prasadam and kill yourself that way too, I think. Eat yourself to death, you could do that, so that's not healthy, obviously. So the other thing is that prasadam is there and you can take a lot of halava, but then we know that if you eat all the halava with the ghee and the sugar in it, it's not going to be very good for your consciousness or your body. So it ends up also in the mode of ignorance in terms of quantities. Yeah? So not only what we eat, but also how much we eat also is important in terms of rajasattva tama. Huh? So one in sattvic mode will eat enough, which is good for his nourishment, but he won't take more than that. One in mortal passion will eat more, and one in mortal ignorance will just do anything. Torture his body to death. Mm-hmm. Oh, Narada Bhakti Sutra. I haven't gone into that so much, Narada Bhakti Sutra, so I don't know so much about it.
There are only certain places were mentioned, but the eyes weren't mentioned.
Yeah, and the ears, yeah. The nose.
So we only have four regulative principles, where the Christian can choose the ten, so they're told not to steal, and not to kill, and not to lie.
Yeah.
Does that assume that, you know, as long as we don't eat people, we're allowed to kill them, and we can steal, and we can lie, and something, then we're not told not to do that?
Yeah. Then we can't do all the other things. Well, there is one do not in the angas of bhakti, that one of the doors of bhakti, that's number 19, I think, and that is do not disturb any living entity. Prani, and any living entity that has prana, you don't disturb them, don't cause them unnecessary disturbance. So that would cover everything, I think, eh? Lying, cheating, hitting, violence, anything, you know, against any living entity, not just human beings also. Huh? And the tenth anga, the positive ones, the first ten, the tenth one is respect the datri tree and the asvata tree and the cow and the something like that, you know, and the brahmana. So that is like the positive aspect. We should respect all living entities, animals and plants and human beings, not just Vaishnavas, but in general, you know, all living entities, we should give respect to them. And again, of course, that other one is that don't come under the control of lamentation, etc. So that would cover a lot of the negative things we want to do in the material world, too. On the other hand, Rupa Goswami says that morality is not an anga of bhakti. In other words, separately to cultivate goodness or honesty or things, that is not an anga. We're not trying to cultivate honesty or things like that. It's a separate anga. But we have to avoid certain things in the pursuance of the cultivating devotion.
So morality comes
to
consequence anyway.
Yeah. But on the other hand, we have to avoid, you know, real negative things at the same time. Otherwise, our that is why these things, you know, we have to follow also. We can't indulge in all these things because it just negates the bhakti we do. We can say that all the good qualities that people strive for in morality are also inherent in the jiva by nature. And these become revealed through the process of bhakti, because the nature of the jiva is revealed through bhakti. So therefore the natural qualities of all good qualities will be revealed. And therefore if we indulge in the opposite, this will not encourage that development of the soul, the development of those qualities. Therefore that's why we don't indulge in the opposite. Yeah. These things. Oh, why is the yoga system dangerous? Well, this was some comment that I heard in one book, huh? And the reason why is that, as I said, the people are not, let's say, emotionally and spiritually equipped to handle the opening of different chakras. And when it happens, then they freak out and they get a lot of mental problems. Huh? And it is a common experience, not only in yoga, but in Qigong in China. They apparently have special hospitals for the people that end up going crazy as a result of practicing on their own Qigong or something like that. You know, the breathing exercises and meditation, and then they start going crazy. They have hallucinations and all sorts of things happening to them. They open the chakras and all these entities come in and all sorts of things happen. So they have mental problems. In Tibetan Buddhism, also, it's the same thing. They have to be very careful to do their meditation under some teacher. Otherwise, you can go crazy doing that also. In Buddhist meditation, you can go crazy also. end up as a, like, schizophrenic or something. That's also pretty bad. In other words, that really tears up your subtle body. We don't see that because you just take it and it goes in your system, but actually it really disturbs your subtle body. That alcohol does, even cigarettes does it. It messes up all your whole subtle body, you know, and there's a lot of problems in it. Meat will also do it, red meat in particular. It makes a whole mess of your subtle body. No, the subtle body is not. The subtle body is physical. It's subtle physical. Yeah? It's a mental body. Yeah? Yeah? The soul obviously is, you can't even touch it in one sense. However, like we have a gross body, a subtle body, and we have a soul. So the subtle body, we can say, is next closer to the soul than the gross body. So we got most gross, then we got subtle body, and then we got soul, the most subtle of all. So the subtle body is like an intermediary between the gross body and the soul. It's just like a subtle version of this body is the subtle body. Huh? And there's an interaction between these two bodies also. So if something happens in this body, it affects the subtle body. If something happens in the subtle body, it affects the gross body. It goes back and forth, you know, cross effects. And then ultimately the soul is sitting there consequently getting the effects of both in terms of illusion. Yeah? The soul can't suffer ultimately because you can't kill it, you can't do anything to it. But the soul identifies with the gross body and the mind. And therefore if they experience pain, the soul experiences pain. Just like in a dream, you have a dream body and then you suffer. And then when you wake up, so I didn't suffer because it wasn't me, this is me. But you suffered in your dream body. So like that, we're associating with this body and this subtle body, and this causes me suffering. But actually it's not you at all. You're the soul. But we identify with it, therefore we suffer. So the yoga system concentrates on developing the control of the mind by certain means, like that. And once you control the mind, and that means ultimately desires, then you get rid of desires. Then we have no more material desires. But then we get rid of karma. Then you get liberated. That's how they do it. Our process is a little different. So in other words, they are purifying the subtle body and bringing it to a very peaceful, calm state, and then become empty of all desires. So our process is a little different. We engage everything, not just stop all the activities and stop the desires. Rather, we simply engage everything out of devotion for Krishna, using the senses, using the mind, using everything. So we substitute for the kama, we substitute prema, basically. So then we fill everything up with prema from the soul into the subtle body. And that way we control.
Is it necessary to be mindful of thoughts? How to be mindful?
Mindful of our thoughts. Sounds like Buddhist. It sounds very Buddhist to me. Well, in the Nectar Devotion, it says all the angas of bhakti actually are ultimately simply come down to two angas. That is, always remember Krishna, never forget him. So in other words, all the actions you do somehow should relate back to serving Krishna favorably. I'm attempting to please him with my actions. And to avoid the opposite. So in a sense, ultimately, we should be mindful. Yeah? Yeah. Where our thoughts are going all the time. Yeah. So the process of devotion is ultimately to bring the thoughts all the way back to somehow thinking of serving Krishna favorably.
in the beginning of that Krishna chant, when we first start chanting, we usually got a lot of reasons why we chant, you know, we've been the least of the material world and all that. But after a while, you can reach a stage where you just realize that you can actually stop chanting, the life is not so desperate anymore, you're
out
of desperation. And then you're comfortable with the material life again. And, you know, things come back on all the time, and to get your balance down is really difficult.
Gradually we develop more attraction for Krishna and less attraction for material things. So therefore, the symptom of advancement would be that chanting would not be difficult. It would become easier. It would be more attractive to us. And we may sacrifice something of the material world to do that instead as we advance. So if we find that we have difficulty in chanting, then that's a sign that actually we're still stuck on a lower level. And that we do have to, you know, stick on with our sadhana very carefully in order to develop that attraction more and more, so it becomes easier. Otherwise, we can keep going down, down, down after that. We lose the attraction and we get less and less and less attraction as a result of that.
Bharat.
Well, he was on the stage of bhava, which is very high, because he had an actual experience of God. An actual experience of God with ecstatic symptoms. And then he forgot. He actually forgot the whole thing. And he didn't worship Narayana anymore, and he worshipped the deer instead. So we can say, how is that possible? It is possible because even in bhava, it is not 100% pure. So there's a little bit of something there which can ignite and cause you to come down. So one, even in bhava stage, one has to be careful. After one has seen God, one has to be careful also. If one is on prema, then there is no possibility of falling. One is 100% pure. But in bhava, even with the darshan of the Lord, still there is some little something which can cause problems. So, in other words, we have to be careful in all stages after prema. We're very careful.
I heard before in the lecture that even in the beginning stage of sudden bhakti, there's overlap, even if there's a bhava there.
Well, there's what is called bhava bhas, or ratiya bhas, which means a slight manifestation of symptoms on a lower stage. Rupa Goswami gives the example that someone meets devotees and he's, you know, it's new and everything, but then he must show some, feel some, not as strong as on bhava, but some effects like that, and he may exhibit some ecstatic symptoms like crying and shivering and fainting, whatever, which are not fake. So that is the type of abhas. It's temporary, and it'll go away, and it won't stay very long. So it's possible these things can come, you know, like that, on lower stages. By the mercy of Krishna, he can give an experience he wants at any stage, of course, just to stimulate you or to encourage you or whatever. He can also do that. But in general, we'll be at a certain state, and we may have a temporary thing, but then we'll come back to that state, and then we have to work our way up gradually anyway.
That because of unfulfilled desire.
Yes.
So if we have, let's say, especially the husband and wife relationship, you know, sometimes the
anger.
Sometimes the wife will, you know, say things like that, especially your wife, I don't really understand that we easily get sometimes get affected, but if with friends and or we don't get
you're affected more by what the wife says. More angry.
I just wonder whether it's because of unfulfilled desires, or it's just because of just husband and wife Lila. I don't know.
Oh, I see. Well, I would think it would depend on each relationship. But basically, the relationship of the husband and wife is very close, yeah? And they're also expecting so many things from each other. So if it's not fulfilled, then the opposite tendency will be that the anger will also be there, because of the strong attachment and the strong expectation. And if it's not fulfilled, then they'll become equally angry. So it may come out quite intense if they have an intense expectation, and it's not fulfilled. And they'll feel that.
So you also can relate to unfulfilled
desires. Yeah, to our strong attachment and our expectations. And then we get anger if it's not fulfilled or thwarted or somehow blocked, or defeated or whatever.
And be forced to go and false people.
Well, yeah, false ego is technically our identification with the material body. And then the other false ego, which we call ahankara, is pride. So pride, again, is a manifestation of our, we can say it's a manifestation of ahankara in terms of our own desire to get our identity and then enjoy in that identity. And then we have expectations against that, and then we can develop attachments, and if not fulfilled, then we get the anger.
What do the scientists, they attribute the moon causing the shadow on the earth, in the eclipse? The scriptures say the light is
moon? What do scientists say? Yeah, the moon is going in front of the sun, yeah? Yeah. Well, that actually, if we look at the mathematical definition of Rahu in astrology, it comes up to be the same thing. Because exactly the mathematical definition, how it's calculated, corresponds to that exact point which intersects with the, at that point when the, the moon comes in front of the sun. And it'll only do that when that mathematical point comes in at that point, So, in other words, it's an intersecting point of the orbit of the moon with the elliptic or the horizontal. That is the Earth going around the sun. That's the horizontal, and then there's an inclined plane of the moon going around the Earth. So where the two points intersect, where that this plane intersects that plane, there's two points called Rahu and Ketu. And when they line up in a certain way with the sun and the moon, then they get eclipse. So then Rahu actually does conjoin at that point. That point Rahu conjoins. Otherwise you just get Amavasya, regular black moon. But when Rahu joins in there, then you'll get eclipse. The points, which are called Chaya Graha, which means shadow planets or subtle planets. Not with the gross, forms like the other planets.
Just a comment for the question for the soul themselves. Realistically, they say the husband and wife goes down, but in the later years, the relationship comes up again. In the 50s.
When they lose their desires and expectations. So they have to tolerate in between. Well, that's part of the whole thing here, that in sadhana bhakti itself, one has to, you know, take care of one's spiritual life, and therefore one has to watch out for the vegas, because the vegas will lead to the next thing in the next verse, which are unfavorable for bhakti. So therefore you have to control. And nobody else is going to do it for you. You'd have to do it yourself.
And also,
What's happening?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That we had the whole big thing in America the other year. Twin Towers, and that sparked a whole another level of violence in the world, or fear in the world, or anxiety in the world, etc. Before, we used to have the nuclear weapon thing. Yeah. Now it's not even nuclear weapons anymore. It's different. It's not powerful like that. It's completely different, but it's there again. It's just a fear in another form, anxiety and insecurity in another form. So that's just another aspect of Kali Yuga. And there's no real way of preventing that. Also, like Bush is saying so many things, and then he can't fulfill it, so he says something else, and then does something else. Tries to catch somebody else or fight with somebody else. And if he keeps switching around like this, but never going to solve the problem that way, because ultimately the problem comes back to, again, one's own activities. We get what we deserve in one sense. Yeah. And if we do violence, we get violence. That's basically what's the whole idea of karma. So it can happen to countries, and it can happen to individuals, and it can happen to the world also. Yeah, basically. But it was a very dramatic display of destruction of civilization. The whole thing, how it just happened. It was a very it's like something out of a movie. Very symbolic at the same time, you know, very symbolic the way it happened in New York with the Twin Towers, with airplanes crashing into it, one after the other, and everyone just looking at it helplessly, not doing anything. Yeah. Very symbolic of our whole world, in one sense. Well, it seems like that. Nobody is spared from violence in this world. Okay. Hare Krishna.